Welcome everyone to our class, our Shir Parshas Miketz Vayigash 5775, Clueless in Canaan. In case you don't know the allusion, there was a movie about 20 years ago called Sleepless in Seattle, so I tried to keep the same structure. We spoke a couple of weeks ago about dreams. I dreamed a dream in time gone by, and we spoke about how dreams follow the interpretation. Very clearly, when the Sar HaMashkim, the chief of the wine butler, says to Pharaoh that this young boy, Joseph, how he interpreted our dreams, exactly how it played out. And the rabbis and the Gemara say that the dream goes after the interpretation of the dream. And we say that stunningly, amazingly, we learned that the brothers were the ones who interpreted Joseph's dream. Joseph just simply reported the facts, the information of his dreams. The brothers responded, oh my gosh, you're going to rule over us, you're going to lord it over us. That was the brothers. That wasn't Joseph. And we said that it could have been a benign yerida. Yes, the Jewish people needed to go down to Egypt. That was a fact. It was given to Abraham, to Avraham Avinu, in the covenant of the parts, the priest Ben HaBesarim. This was a fact, right? We say this in the Passover Haggadah every year. Your children will be strangers in a strange land. But it didn't have to work out with Joseph being sold as a slave and the whole trials and tribulations that were subsequent to that. It could have been a benign yerida. They were going to go, yes. But why not have Joseph in power? And then the brothers have an easy time. It didn't have to be with all the nefarious activities of the brothers versus Joseph and back and forth. What I would like to talk about tonight is something that always bothered me. I've never really had a satisfactory answer. How come the brothers are unable to understand that this is Joseph? I understand he has a new name. Great. He's Safnat Paneach, the one who explains hidden things. Great. It's nice to have a little working name for the public. But come on. You think stories of a kid who went from the outhouse to the penthouse in 3 seconds, who was an Eved, a slave to Potiphar, and rises to become the most powerful, most charismatic, the rock star of Egypt. I mean, even Pharaoh says, look, I'm Pharaoh, but Rak HaKisei Egdal Mimecha, right? It's only the throne that I inherited from my dad and my grandfather. That makes me Pharaoh. I understand. But come on, Joseph, you're the one who's going to lead the people in this time of need with the impending doom and destruction of the famine. It's you. You're Mr. Charismatic. You're Mr. Chayin. It's got to be you, not me. So he takes the ring off, says, you're in charge of the army. I mean, we know he was in charge of the army, ostensibly rules the country. And yet, for all of this, Joseph, they used to throw jewelry at him, the young ladies, as he walked through the streets, trying to get his attention. You know, he was Elvis Presley, the Beatles, all woven into one. The women went crazy. They climbed the walls trying to get a peek at this unbelievably handsome, charismatic young man who at age 30 rose to become the prince, king of Egypt, right? So how is it possible that word doesn't spread back to the adjacent territory called Canaan, Israel? Of course it would have. And as the brothers come, we're told that they split up into 10 different gates. They all enter through TSA agents at 10 different entry points into Egypt. And they were given, the TSA agents, who control the traffic and flow into Egypt during the years of Safa, plenty, then the subsequent years of famine, they were given, you know, pictures. Look out for anyone named son of Jacob. Bring him to me, Joseph said. And he, of course, utilized this information and said, well, why would a family of brothers, why would they choose to enter different entry points? Wouldn't you come into the land through Ben-Gurion? Or through Cairo, the main entry point, why would you all feel the need of subterfuge? And he used this is Meraglim Atem, right? You're spies. Who else would split up and try to conceal their identity as a family? But my point being, they were aware that Joseph is in Egypt because the Ishmaelites, who they sold him to, were on their way down. And yes, he was sold multiple times. And they didn't know his ultimate fate, alive or dead, but they were looking for him because, my gosh, they wanted to bring Joseph back home. It wasn't too late. They were hoping to find him, pay any sum of money, redeem him, and bring him back to Jacob because they understood the enormity and the gravity of what they had done to their father. Their father was not the same person. He had been a dead man walking for the last 22 years, so they were desperate to restore Joseph. So here, they're brought in front of the king of Egypt, which, of course, is normal for the king of Egypt to be the one who is like there on the line, the food lines, you know, discussing who's going to get. Okay, that's another point. And what happens? They show up in front of him, and this is right away. He recognizes them. Now, Ramban, Nachmanides, says, well, how did he know them? Because clearly they were much older than him. At least the older brothers, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Judah, were much, much older than Joseph and Benjamin. And so they were already full grown. They had their beards. So maybe a little more white in the beard now, but ostensibly they're the same person. But the Ramban says, but wait a minute, some of the younger brothers, like Yisachar, Zevulun, were not much older than Joseph. But the context of seeing them with the guys he knew, 10 together, who else could it be but his brothers? And he expected them to come. They obviously didn't expect to see him there. They don't recognize him. So let's look inside. Okay? Source number one. Now, Joseph was the ruler over the land. In 1 minute. Let's go through source one and we'll come right back to you, okay? Joseph was the ruler over the land, and it was he who sold grain to the entire populace of the land. So Joseph's brothers come, they bow down to him, faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he made himself a stranger to them. He spoke to them harshly, and he said, where do you guys come from? They said, well, Meretz Canaan, Lishbar Ochel, we came from the land of Canaan to buy food. Joseph recognized his brothers, Vehem Lohikiru, but they didn't recognize him. And then Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about them, and he said, ah, Meragli Matem, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness, to spy out the land. Yes.
Which of the forefathers asked God to make him become older in appearance?
Abraham.
Jacob?
Abraham.
Abraham?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. He was the first person. We say in Hallel, some people add at the end of the Hallel, of Abraham, Zakein Bayamim, Vahashem Beirach et Abraham Bakol, that he became old. He was the first person to look old, which gave him zikna, this old appearance, which was hush. It was important for Abraham. Very good point. Thank you. Number two, Rashi. So Rashi says, now Joseph recognized. Why? Because he had left them when they were already full bearded. It's all about the beard. But they did not recognize him, source 3 says, because when he left, he was not full bearded. Joseph had no beard. He was a young man. He was 17 years old. And now they found him full bearded. That's the only reason given by Rashi for how come they can't. I don't know about you. But this is a problem for me. You wouldn't recognize your own brother. Now, it's going to become a bigger problem in a few moments as we go through the story and see that Joseph really wasn't making a very difficult attempt to hide his identity. He really was throwing hints out all throughout the story. And the brothers were clueless in Canaan. Totally clueless, oblivious to who Joseph really was. We have to discuss this, okay? Now, there's another opinion that maybe he wore like the gangster look. You know, he had the Borsellino black hat and he kind of put it down over his eyes a little bit to shade his face. You know, but come on. You're talking to your brother, Joseph. Yeah, I understand he's your little brother. But Joseph was a spitting image of, we know, Jacob. So you're telling me that when they see this man, even, okay, fine. You say, okay, but he wore the garb of the Egyptians, clearly, right? You've all seen the drawings and you know they wore the fancy, the gold and the thing. But are you telling me if you saw somebody dress up in Purim, your own brother or sister, put on a Purim costume like an Egyptian and look a little bit like Yul Brynner or I don't know, the famous woman from the Ten Commandments or some famous actresses in the movie The Ten Commandments, they made up a story about her. So you wouldn't recognize your own brother or sister even in Egyptian garb? I mean, really? And we're going to see that it's compounded by the story itself. Okay? The voice. Now, in fact, wouldn't they have understood that he spoke Hebrew? Wouldn't they have said, well, wait a minute. You went to Giver Pernikov's Hebrew classes, the crash course coming up in February. You speak Hebrew? No Egyptian speaks Hebrew. How could this be? So we're told, ki hamelitz beinotam. Right there's a translator. But where did the translator get his Hebrew skills? Did he go to Giveret's classes? Where in the world do you get a guy to speak Hebrew? Lashon Ivrit, the Lashon HaKodesh, that's another problem, right? And it's compounded because Joseph's standing there, and he has his son Menashe as his translator, okay? And the brothers are speaking to Menashe. It's like the UN, right, where they have the little headphones on, and no one understands what the other one's saying. They just nod, yes, Israel must be condemned. Well, what about Iran? They're about to blow up the world. No, we care about that settlement across the street from the bank Lumi. But Iran's going to nuke the world. There's 4,000 people in Nigeria. Women were held hostage and raped. But we care about those Israelis building that building. Right? I mean, that's the UN. When they put on the, you know, the little headphones and, right? Going right just down the street 2 hours from now. Crazy people. Okay. We digress in a humorous way. But unfortunately, a very sadly true way. So here's a translator going back and forth. And Joseph's listening. But of course, he has to pretend that when his brothers speak in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew, that he doesn't understand what they're saying. So he's like, you know, playing a little game, and then Menashe reaches over and says, you know, right, or in Egyptian he would speak, and then he would answer in Egyptian only, and they would speak back and forth. So it's a whole ruse going on here, to the point where at one point, Joseph hears them actually admit their culpability, right? And he gets moved. When he hears them, he's not supposed to understand what they say because they're whispering among each other, and he's like listening, and there's no Menashe. Menashe's on a bathroom break. So at one point, the brothers are like talking about, oh my gosh, it's because of what we did to Joseph that all this bad stuff's happening. And Joseph's moved, and he has to like run away and not show himself to be crying in their presence. Okay, let's get back to number four.
Get to show in public that he knew Hebrew.
Because Pharaoh had to know 70 languages, we're told, to be Pharaoh, right? He took the Rosetta Stone courses before Rosetta Stone.
He told Joseph, you can learn to me, but don't tell him.
Correct.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I'm talking about his son.
Correct.
Who's playing the interpreter.
Correct. Well, where you're saying, where would he have learned his Hebrew knowledge?
From his father. But
No. In the appearance of the brothers, where could he have learned Hebrew, you're asking? Why wouldn't they be suspicious?
And why wouldn't... He's going to be publicly speaking Hebrew?
Correct. So I would offer to you the following, that even though Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, they had a little following in, you know, in the land of Israel and Canaan, any great official is going to have the best of the best on staff. So you're right. It is another question. Maybe the brothers could have gotten together and said, where did this guy Menashe, this young man, where did he go to school to learn his Hebrew skills? But that never occurred to them. I guess they just felt this, the court of the most powerful king on earth. Naturally, he's going to have a translator for every language known to mankind. And they probably didn't stop. They were probably overwhelmed by the circumstance to think too hard, like you are. You're picking a good point here. That's another valid point. How come the fact that there was a translator of this language, where did he get the translation skills? It's a great point. I can't answer that. We'll try to answer that at the end of tonight. Okay?
Did Menashe know who they were?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, they were his uncles, and he knew they were his uncles. He had to be in on it. Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. Any other comments while we...
Well, how did he know that they were his uncles? He never saw them.
Right, but Joseph would have taught them. He taught both Menashe and Ephraim the Torah.
Now, here's
and
what
all
your
about
uncles
the family.
Look like. They have beards.
No. But when they came into the court beforehand, he said, I'm arresting them. He must have confided in his son the plan. Or the plan would not have had effect. Menashe, as we'll see, plays an integral role. He's the one who places the magic goblet into Benjamin's sack later in Mikade. So he's part of the ruse. He's in on it, right? So he must have confided. Probably went home and they had a family meeting, and Ephraim was there, and the lovely gracious Asnat was there, his wife, right? So they were all in on it. Okay, let's go to number four. So right away he accuses them of being spies. And he knows that his life's in danger because, kaboom, if he locks them up, he incarcerates them. If he allows Shimon and Levi to get together, he knows what happened. You ask the people, the late citizens of the city of Shechem, what happens when you cross a member of Shimon and Levi's family? You die. Everybody. So he was desperate because he knew that if Shimon and Levi are somehow conspiring together as brothers, they're capable of anything. So he's determined to separate them. Plus, he has a bragus. He's angry at them because it was Shimon and Levi, we are told, who are the ones who mocked him and hurt him the most. They wanted to kill him. But when they see him coming, it says, Hine balach alamos alazaba. Who said those words? Shimon said it to Levi. Ish alachiv. It doesn't say who to whom, but we know later on from a deduction in Rashi, I won't take you through it, that the two brothers who were inseparable were Shimon and Levi. He was desperate to separate them, and Shimon was the one who mocked and hurt Yosef the most. So he figured, you know, if I'm going to select one to stay here at the Ritz-Carlton Palace, as you'll see in a minute, it's going to be Shimon, nobody else. So he selects Shimon. Shimon, of course, looks around, and he says, you're going to lock me up? You and what army? So Joseph says, you know, that's a good point. So what does Joseph do? Look at number five. Number four and five. And in prison, Simeon, I love it, before their eyes. It says he only imprisoned him before their eyes. But as soon as the brothers left, they went back home, he released Shimon and gave him food and drink, put him up at the Ritz-Carlton, Cairo. No problem at all. Now listen to this, Yalkut Shimoni, this Medrash. I love this Medrash. I'm paraphrasing. Number five. Shimon said, okay, I want to see which one of you little Egyptian pipsqueaks is going to put me, Shimon, the one who wiped out at age like 12 and 13, wiped out the city of Shechem. I want to see what you guys are made of. So Joseph immediately picked up his cell phone and he called for help. He said, Pharaoh, can you please send 70 of the commandos, because I need help here. These guys are serious guys. So the 70 came. Joseph told them, okay, see the chain over there, the shoshalos? I want you to put it on the neck of this nefarious-looking character, pointing to Shimon. So the 70 pick up the chain. They're coming towards Shimon. He just lets out a battle cry, a shriek. And the guys crack their teeth on the ground. They're so scared. He says, oh, I guess plan A didn't work. So he turns to Menashe. He says, Menashe, take the chain, and you see the man over there? I want you to imprison the man in the chain. So Menashe walks over, gives him a karate kick, kaboom, knocks Shimon right out, puts him in chains. Shimon, after he has the smelling salts given to him, looks up and he's stunned. And he turns to his family, and look what he says. He says, that blow, that maka, was Ben Abba. It was from someone of our father's house. Really? You think, Shimon? So the brothers actually said, only a Jew, only someone from Yaakov's family, that means our family, could have hit someone with such power. Okay, stop. The next step is, well then, if that's the case, but no, they don't go there. Okay, this is just point one. Do you all hear it? In other words, the brothers themselves articulated one to another already. It's got to be someone from the family of Jacob who could have had such a punch. Come on. No, didn't bother them. Okay, next. Number six, they go back home. And we know famously the money that they paid for all their shever, for their food, was put back by design in their sacks. Levi is the first one to discover it. When they empty the sacks in front of Jacob, they're all horrified because everyone had their money there. So one having money returned, that could be mishkehu, right? Could be a mistake, an oversight. Everybody? It's a setup, right? And their hearts fall, and they're upset. And then they hear, they report to Jacob. Oh, this man, we told him everything, and he said we're spies. Because Jacob, said, what? Loose lips sink ships, my sons. You fools. Why would you tell this man? Ha'od lachem ach? You have another brother, so now he wants Benjamin to come? Idiots! Why did you have to say anything about that? Do you even have a brother named Benjamin? Dad, it was crazy. He knew everything about us. He grilled us. He fired at us. He knew the decor of our nursery. My goodness. Have number six. And Israel, Yaakov said, why have you harmed me by telling the man that you have another brother? They said, but the man asked about us. Ulam ol adateinu, and about our family. Saying, ha'od avichem chai, is your brother still, ha'od avichai, is your father's dad still loving? Ha'od avichem av, do you have a brother? We told him according to these words. Could we have known that he would say, then bring Benjamin down? Look at Rashi number seven, about us and our family. About our lineage. Midrashically, in the oral tradition, the Midrash, it says, it is explained, the drash is, even the matters of our cradles he revealed to us. Gee, stop for a second, brothers. How could this Egyptian ruler know the details of what type of diapers you bought at Baby R Us? Did you use Desitin, or did you use, you know, the other, whatever? How is this possible? Really? Really, think about it, guys. No, doesn't cross their mind, right? Nobody. Doesn't, zero impact.
Are they really that ignorant?
No. They can't be. They're brilliant. We're going to see. But you see how the question is getting compounded in its frustration, right? You almost are saying, guys, just stop. Time out. Stop. Now, let's give them a benefit for a moment. Let's just go back to what we said at the beginning, at the outset. The brothers created this nightmare. Remember this. They interpreted the dream. They saw Joseph, the righteous, Hatzadik, in a certain way. And they were literally the instrument of the fulfillment of the dreams that they had interpreted for themselves. Joseph never interpreted them that way. So sometimes when you have what they call self-fulfilling prophecy, you play a major role in the cue and fulfillment of that prophecy. And there's no question that when you're in the midst of something, it's hard to digress and to divest yourself from it and step back. We all know that we've been caught up in situations in multiple circumstances where you say, okay, time out. That's why they even have timeouts in sports, right? Because when there's a, I mean, you know sports a little bit, when there's a run in basketball, for example, you know, someone gets 12, 14 points in a row, immediately it's a halacha, it's a law, right? The coach has to call a timeout. Sometimes they'll even call multiple timeouts to try to break up the run that the other team is just hot, right? They call multiple timeouts. Why do they do that? Because the team needs to take a breather, just sit on the bench, gather your thoughts, gather, oh my gosh, you had a plan of action, now it's gone. You're not even thinking, you idiots. Come on, get it together again. Let's remember, we had a game plan, you don't let number 23 for the Bulls touch the ball, you block, whatever, you know, it's Michael Jordan. You stop, you had a game plan, but now he's just touching the ball and shooting from everywhere. What do? We're going to break up the rhythm, we're going to stop. We're going to go back and try to recreate the pregame thoughts and the mindset. That's what they do in sports, that's what they do in life. But we don't do it. Often we get so caught up in whatever is happening. So I would say that part of the problem is they're in a process. Whenever you're living a process of something and it exponentially increases its velocity towards an end, it's very hard to go, time out, I'm going to stop the process. I think you will agree that when we do, you're better for it. If it's a bad process, you got to just stop and say, okay, wait a minute. Let's just see, is the lunacy of this or not? Okay, we'll speak about this in a very profound way, I hope, this Shabbos. It's a little teaser. Okay, number 8. So, the brothers return, and they are anxious. Oh my gosh, the money. It's all about the money. This guy's going to accuse us of having stolen the money that was placed in our sacks. We don't know. Misam kaspeinu v'amta chaseinu. We don't know. We'll put our money back in our sacks. Oh my gosh, what's going to happen when we go back, right? And they're so anxious that as soon as they arrive, the first words out of their mouth, and they, it's like you sense in the Chumash, it's kind of cute actually, because they go, it's like 6 psukim in a row, and they're like, we came originally just to buy food, and we gave the money, we don't know who put the money back, we found the money back there. And then Menashe says, Shalom, it's okay. And you sense the brother's like, and he says, it's okay, I don't know what the problem is. Why are you getting bent out of shape? I got the money, paid in full. Oh, you have money that was put in your sack? I guess your God must have given you a matmon. He gave you a little gift. Come on, relax. And let's go to the palace for lunch. Let's go to the palace for lunch. Okay. I was one step from the dungeon as an accused spy. And of course, it's normal that accused spies get to dine with the king in the palace at lunch. This makes absolute sense, right? Does it? I mean, it's insane, right? Look at number 8. And the man did, I mean, Menashe, as Joseph had said, and the man brought the men into Joseph's house for lunch. Now the men were frightened because they had been brought into Joseph's house, and they said, oh my gosh, why are we here? On account of the money that came back in our sacks at first, and we are brought to roll upon us, to accuse us, and to fall upon us, and to take us as slaves, and our donkeys as well. I always loved as a kid. Yeah, but it's not just us that we're going to be slaves, but we're going to take our donkeys. Well, because taking the donkeys is like taking the car keys. Because without the donkeys, they don't have any mobility. They can't go back home. So it's like, say, give me the car keys. I'm confiscating the car keys. You're not driving anymore. So you take away, don't take away my donkey keys. Okay, so he says, we're taking the donkeys also. Number 9. Before we get there, so the brothers come, and they're anxiously waiting for the meal. And Joseph comes, Tzafnas Paneach, and he sees Benjamin. And he hasn't seen Binyamin since Binyamin was a little guy. Now, Binyamin is not a little guy. He's about 30 years old. Not only that, but as he talks to Binyamin, he finds out that Binyamin has had 10 sons born to him. Joseph missed out on every brit, on every circumcision, a whole life of his little brother being grown up. So he's really, really touched by Benjamin. Benjamin didn't do anything to him. So the animus that he may have is limited really to the older brothers alone. Okay? So he sees Benjamin, he says to him, he asks him about his family, and Benjamin tells him that each of the sons is named for Joseph. And poor Joseph just can't handle this because it's profound. Each of Benjamin's 10 sons was named in some way, shape, or form, something to do with Joseph's disappearance, his loss, how great Joseph was. Rashi goes through each name and explains to us, and we won't do that tonight, but that's your homework. So what happens? Joseph lifted his eyes, this says in number 9, and he saw Binyamin, his brother, son of his mother. See how it puts the accent on, there's the Rachel factor here, Rachel Imenu, right? And he said, is this your little brother whom you told me about? He's also mocking them a little bit because he's like 30 years old, he's 6'5", 210 pounds, and they're always talking about, Achinu Hakaton, Imenu Iman, right? Our little brother. brother. So he's expecting a little brother. This guy's a strapping, handsome young man. He's not excited. This is your little brother, right? You're so worried about his safety. Really? And then he turns to Binyamin and gives him a bracha. He says, may God favor you, my son. Which, of course, is normal for a pharaoh to quote God. Not exactly. Not exactly. In Egyptian. Undoubtedly in Egyptian. It's recorded in Lashon HaKodesh, in the Torah.
And did the brother know that's what he was saying?
If they asked Menashe, who was the translator, they probably said, hey, what did he just do? Maybe he just said in Egyptian, unbeknownst to anyone. It's not clear. It's a good point. It's a very good point. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer. And Joseph hastened. Why? For his mercy was stirred toward his brother Benjamin, and he wanted to weep. So he went into the room and wept there, washed his face, came out, put on his evil face, restrained himself, and said, serve the food. So you see that Joseph himself, it's normal, of course, to look at a brother, and the brothers must see Joseph well up with tears. It's noticeable. And he just sprints out of the room into another chamber, and he cries his eyes out, comes back, washes the tears. This is normal, right? The brothers are probably looking like, this guy's insane. He looked at her little brother, and now he's breaking down in tears. Does it make an impact on the brothers? Apparently not. So number 10, they sat before him. It says, HaBechor kiBechor Aso, the firstborn according to his age is firstborn, VaHatzair kiTzair Aso, the youngest according to his youth, or his yut, as they would say. And the men looked at each other in astonishment. Why were they astonished? Exactly. So look at number 11. The firstborn according to his age. It's a great question. So what he did is he picked up his little goblet. He looked at the table. There's like a golden goblet there, a little kiddush cup, right? He picked it up. It's bar mitzvah. It probably said, you know, Joseph ben Yaakov, bar mitzvah, land of Canaan, you know, rabbi so-and-so. All right. Gift from Ohad Tzedek. Okay. So he picks up his kiddush cup and he kind of bangs on the kiddush cup because it's there. And he says, okay. And he's setting up, of course, the later part of the story. So he says, okay, my magic kiddush cup tells me. And he looks, he says, wait a minute. And he points to Judah. He says, you know, I thought you were number one. I thought you were the Bechor, the firstborn, because you're the big talker here. You're doing all the talking for the family. You're not even the Bechor. He says, you're nothing. You're number four. Why don't you close your mouth, Mr. Big Talker? And he turns to Reuven, who's standing somewhere else. He says, you know, you're really the Bechor. You sit at the head of the table. And he turns around. Shimon, you're next. Levi? Oh, now, Judah, you go ahead. And he goes all the way down. Now, this was not a small thing because the brothers were born within 9 months or less of each other if you're from Bilhah and Zilpah. And the beards, they were almost indistinguishable from one another. They probably got mixed up who was whom, right? Let alone, how could a stranger differentiate? The age disparity was so small. It was an enormous feat, which he attributed, of course, to the magic cup. But still, it was an amazing idea that he could do this. Now comes my favorite part. Okay? He knocked on his goblet and announced, okay, and then he goes through the sons. Son of one mother, you guys sit here, which is the order of your birth. He did all of them. When he reached Binyamin, this is my favorite part, he says to Binyamin, you don't have a mother, do you? No. She died at age 36. Oh my gosh, that's horrible. Guess what? Coincidentally, I also am orphaned. My mom died at age 36. What a coincidence. Why don't you sit at my table privately, and the other your brothers will sit over there by themselves, and you'll sit at the head table with me, you and me alone. What do you say, Binyamin? Hello? What is he trying to say to you? Anyone want to pick up on the hint? No, doesn't pick up on the hint. Right? I mean, amazing, stunning. And then, of course, the most stunning part is the last 12, where he literally, I won't bore you with all the details, but he literally recreates the story of his mom, Rachel, father, Jacob, and when they left Laban's house, what did Rachel take unbeknownst to her husband? The trophim, the idols. And remember what Jacob unfortunately said? Whoever has the idols with them should not live. Exactly the same. You have a child, Benjamin, of Rachel. Something is hidden in his sack. And when the brothers are falsely accused, they say exactly the same words, incidentally. Whoever you find it with should not live. It's crazy, right? Literally. He recreates the story of his own mom's demise and the idols being hidden in Benjamin, but nobody picks up on it. Not a word. And what's absolutely mind-bending is Parshas Vayigash. From beginning until Joseph finally has to say, I am Joseph, what does Judah, Yehuda, try to do? He says, I'm going to figure this out. He says, you guys stay back. because Judah's the king. He steps up, and it's Vayigash Elav Yehuda. It's Judah versus Joseph, the future kings of Israel, because remember, the kings of Israel split along the lines of the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom, and the northern kingdom of Israel. That's where we get the lost tribes coming from, because Joseph's kingdom was overrun by Sancherith and the Assyrians. Okay, it's another story. But what happens? The two kings face off, and the other brothers probably understand. Okay, let's give Judah a little bit of room. He's the lion, and the lion part's coming out right now. And Judah starts, he does everything. Go through Vayigash, you'll see Judah very tersely reviews all the germane facts of the story that we just went through. Let me see how this began. Why did we come down? Then the tale is twisted and we're accused and all the parts, right? And he's desperately trying to figure out, there's got to be logic here, an answer. It's got to make sense. And he's brilliant, but he can't put the final piece of the puzzle together. Now, how do we know this? Because at the point where he threatens the life of Joseph personally, he says, I'm going to start with you, big talker, Judah says, and then I'm going to end with Pharaoh, and every Egyptian in between, we'll take care of this. We'll kill you all. Benjamin's not staying here. Amazing. But it's clear, if you read very carefully, that Joseph didn't want to say who he was at that point. How do we know this? It says, V'lo yachol Yosef lehitapek. He couldn't restrain himself. He wanted to. Now, what did he want and why? And then we'll answer up the big question. He obviously wanted the brothers to figure out who he was. He didn't want to tell them. They needed to figure it out. Why? So is everyone familiar with the expression of a paradigm shift? Okay, I'll give you the most enormous paradigm shift in history. There was a man named Copernicus. And they wanted to kill this man. The church literally, we're gonna lynch him, okay? He's the one who dared to say, maybe our theories of why the orbits don't make any sense is because the Earth is not the center of our galaxy. The sun is, and we all orbit around the sun. So a pre-Copernican world, before Copernicus came up with this idea, the world, the church had to believe the Earth is the center of existence, of creation, right? So when Copernicus comes, and he comes up with this theory that, no, maybe everything made sense, right? The non-elliptical orbits of certain planets, all the band-aids that they put to try to explain why things are, it all just, boom, in one swoop, it all made sense of how the world works. Great. A lot of people didn't like this. He was a very unpopular character. You just put Copernicus into your Wikipedia search, you'll read all about him. I mean, I think he might have been incarcerated for years. Like, I know Galileo was under threat also. Anyone who thinks, you know, chidushim, unusual thoughts, the church does not like this at all, or at least historically. We're resentful. They wanted status quo. Okay. To have an enormous paradigm shift when something goes from what we believe to be a reality to something, a brand new reality. So, for example, Einstein's theory of relativity. A year or two after his theory, what a handful of people in the world, probably physicists, understood what he was really saying. But today, school children understand the theory of relativity. Why? Because you're born into it. It's a reality. So once the next generation comes, it's only the people who are in the shift that cannot pick up on it. The next generation who didn't know any better, like, for example, you use computers. If you were born with an iPad in a world of iPads and iPhones, what's the big deal? It's my existence. But if you were born when not only were there not computers, computers took up an entire shul to operate what one little handheld device would today, like in the old movies, and you see the old black and white, you know, alien movies, and they had like a room full of like the old computers with the tapes and stuff, and you realize that my little iPhone 5 or 6 has more power than the cumulative power of the entire NSA program at that time. It's kind of scary, right? So imagine to somebody who's older, who never grew up with computers, and is now seeing a world changing, what it's like. But what if you're born into it? Like, what if you're like, my little son is 8 years old? This is just a reality. It's a given. This is the way the world is, right? That's what a paradigm shift is. You see this in the Torah in a very striking way, that the generation who left Egypt could not make the trek to Israel. Why? Because that paradigm shift to go from being a slave in Egypt, they knew Egypt. They were the kings. They were the princes. They knew the reality of the facts on the ground. But when they're in the desert, they come to the realization, oh my gosh, if we go to Israel, land of Canaan, they're going to elect new leaders. It's going to be a new generation. We don't have the skills to be the leaders anymore. And that's one of the reasons given by the rabbis why the Meraglim did what they did, why the spies fabricated things about Israel. It's very hard to make a shift in our lifetime.
But here's the key. Joseph understood that in order for the brothers to accept the reality of who he had become and the reality of their existence and what would be with the Jewish people now living in the land of Egypt and surviving in the land of Egypt, they needed to figure out on their own that he's Joseph. And he's putting little clues out all over the place. Come on, guys, figure it out. They can't figure it out. So we understand now why. Joseph needed the brothers to generically on their own, to figure out this is a reality. You see, when you spring a reality on them, it doesn't help. Telling somebody about something, this is the way it is, doesn't have the effect of a person organically coming to the realization of their own accord. Joseph wanted them to. Now you might say, what's the big deal? It's a huge deal. Because did it really work out with Joseph and the brothers long term? No. You see, and we spoke about this in Shabbat, that the brothers are not really reconciled at all. Because as long as Jacob's alive, 17 years, they have like a little bit of a cold peace. As soon as Jacob dies, what's the brother's reaction? Oh my gosh, Joseph's going to lord it over us now. He's going to pay back time now for all those years. So whatever that sort of overture of peace that happened when Jacob comes, it's because dad's alive. But the brothers really don't reconcile. If you look very carefully in Vayigash, when Joseph is crying and talking to the brothers about who he is, what are the brothers doing? What are they doing? Nothing. There's no response. He's gushing over them and crying, and the brothers are like, look inside, you'll see. They don't do anything. There's no response from the brothers. Why? Because they couldn't figure out on their own accord who Joseph was. That's the tragedy. Let's just finish up and then we'll get to all the questions that we have. I know we have tons of questions, okay? Let me just get to the last little piece. So now let's try to answer the big question. How come? How come the brothers just can't figure out that it's Yosef? We're reading the story, and of course we have the benefit of hindsight, and we're all kind of like flummoxed. How come? So let me share a story, a real story with you. My own Rosh Hashiv, my own Rebbe, who is brilliant like Yehuda. Judas. So when we speak about this, remember, we're talking about great, righteous people who are brilliant. All the brilliance of Jews in the world, historically, comes from Judah, Levi, Shimon. Any smart person ever. I mean, Moses is a descendant of Levi, right? King David comes from Judah. So it's, you know, Rabbi Akiva, everyone who ever lived, all the genetics and DNA and brain power come from these individuals. They're the Shvatim, they're the tribes. So God forbid, we're not diminishing their abilities. We're saying there must have been something out of place. And I believe there was. So my Rebbe, my Shiva, brilliant, brilliant man. I'm sharing his Torah with you tonight. He was once taking an airplane ride from Israel, where he lives, to New York. And as he's going back on the airplane to Daven, he notices a religious Jewish man sitting in one of the seats across the aisle. Jumbo airplane. Looks at a man and there's recognition, but he can't put a name to a face, which happens to a lot of us. Looks familiar. But he doesn't feel comfortable going over because he doesn't want to embarrass the man by saying, I don't know who you are. But you look familiar. Nothing happens. Okay. They land. 2 days later, he's at a family wedding. The man's sitting right there at the family wedding. So my Rosh Hashiva, he thinks, oh my gosh, this is like crazy. He's on the airplane. And now he's at my family meal. So he goes over to the man. He said, you know, I'm embarrassed. But I have to ask you something. You were on the airplane coming from Israel. You're here at my family's wedding. You obviously must be part of my life in some way, shape, or form. Do we know each other? The man looks at him and says, Rabbi, I'm your dentist. I'm your dentist. And my Rosh Hashiva says, until that story happened, he didn't understand how can the brothers with a beard or the hat lowered, they don't see Joseph. There's no context. There's no context. When you see the checkout lady from Price Chopper, who you know week in and week out, and you meet her somewhere else out of the context of the Price Chopper, you're like, oh my gosh, I know this person. And you say, yeah, I think so. I've been seeing her for 21 years. But she's not wearing the Price Chopper uniform. You don't expect to see her there. Let's get back to the dreams. The brothers, it can't be Joseph. You're some little evil, maniacal kid at 17 years old who thinks he's going to become the king? It can't be Joseph. There was no context to what they were seeing. So no matter how many clues Joseph keeps throwing their way, it just can't be Joseph. They can't see him. Think about it for a moment. If your perspective is lying down and you expect the doctor with the white smock to stand over you and say, could you open your mouth a little wider, sir, right, till your jaw's breaking, right? That you expect. That's the context. That's how I know you. And that's not a small issue. So I believe this is the answer, that the brothers' interpretation limited their scope of vision. They could never see Joseph. It would not have mattered. Joseph threw enough clues there to sink a battleship, and they're clueless. Why? Because there's no context. But who supplied the context? And this is where it gets, I think, profound. The brothers supplied their own context to the story, didn't they? Every step of the way, the brothers limited the scope and the possibilities and potentiality for what could be. Now, why do I say this is profound? Because I believe that the last quote, number 13, and Joseph said to his brothers, finally, he didn't want to. He says, look, guys, you're not going to figure it out on your own. Judah's about to murder me, so I guess I have no choice. Ani Yosef. He said two words. I am Joseph. Ani Yosef. Ha'ora v'chai, is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him because they were startled by his presence. We are told at the end of time, when we meet our Creator at age 120, or more, God willing, may you live like Yoda to 950, or Noah. When we meet our Creator, he's going to say two words to us. Same two words as Joseph, Ani Hashem, I am God. And we are told by our rabbis, it's a little mystical, that all of our doubts, all of our questions, everything will become crystallized. Everything will make sense. Our lives, our parents, grandparents, everything, all truth will be exposed at that moment. Now, we may be like the brothers, nivhalu, discombobulated to the point where we can't respond. But that's the whole point. I think if we look carefully at our lives, God is like Joseph. He's throwing little bits of hints that I'm with you all the time. They're little, they're subtle. But they're there all the time in our life. He's there as our helper. And he's guiding us. And he's saying, do this, do that. And sometimes, like with the brothers, you struggle how to see it. What's the perspective? But if we put our own, heaven forbid, negative context in our lives, we're never going to see the clues and figure it out. But I really, truly believe that's one of the chavals, one of the horrible situations, is that we define our own reality so often in a negative way. And that with the brothers, it's there as a lesson. It's clearly not here just for effect. Wake up. Ani Yosef, Ani Hashem. He's there. He's with us. He loves us. He cares about us. He wants us to carry on our journey. He wants us to be successful. And at the end, we'll realize that every step of the way, in both positive and negative aspects, we have to praise and thank God both for the good and the bad in our life. You're not allowed just to say, Al HaTov Yizachar Shemecha, that only for the good your name should remember. It has to be for good and bad, because sometimes bad leads to good. We don't know what is good and bad in the scheme of God. So it should be our schut, our merit, that we should never be clueless. We should pick up on the little clues, see the love that Hashem has for us. Look at our own lives, step back, take that time out. Take a second or third time out if you need to stop the flow of negativity in the progression of a life's game of basketball. Take that time out and step back and say, okay, take a deep breath. Relax. Look at your life. Look at what a miracle it is that you are part of this game. We should all be zocha. We should all merit the blessing of awareness and unlimited potentiality for growth. Shabbat shalom.